Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Ten dead, dozens more injured after what appears to be an Israeli airstrike at a UN school. And relief groups continue to struggle with Ebola. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. At least 10 people are dead, another 35 injured after what officials say appeared to be an Israeli strike at a United Nations school sheltering displaced people in Gaza. Witnesses said the explosion in Rafah occurred as people were waiting in line for food. This was the third time in 10 days that a UN school had been hit in such an attack. Meantime, Israel appears to be redeploying troops along its border with Gaza. Scott Bobb reports from Gaza City.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Saturday the ground operation to destroy infiltration tunnels into Israel was nearly ended. Some Israeli ground troops were seen leaving Gaza and redeploying along the boundary with the territory. The military announced that residents of several neighborhoods in northern Gaza could return home. A few returned Sunday, but mostly to recover personal property and inspect their homes. Eman Al-Kahlot, whose extended family of 18 had taken refuge in the UN-run Remal primary school in Gaza, said they would not be going home. She said, "We do not believe what Israel says, because yesterday a family went back. The Israelis bombarded and they died." Scott Bobb, VOA News, Gaza.
Syrian rebels have killed 10 Lebanese soldiers in a cross-border raid that involves some of the worst spillover of violence since Syria's civil war began 3 years ago. The fighting erupted Saturday at the border town of Arsal after rebels were angered by the Lebanese detention of a Syrian who is believed to be a member of Al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, Al-Nusra Front. It's one of the most powerful groups fighting to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Syrian officials say that that has gone on. The Sunni militant Islamic State group has captured a strategic region north of Mosul today, including two oil fields. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Sunni Islamic State militants pursued their advance in the north of Iraq Sunday, capturing territory close to the Turkish and Syrian borders. The area near the Sinjar Mountains is inhabited by the mostly Kurdish-speaking Yazidi minority. A Sharqiya TV reported that hundreds of Yazidi families fled for fear of persecution. Arab satellite channels reported militants captured the strategic Mosul Dam on the Tigris River. Iraq's top aviation chief also gave a press conference Sunday to insist the country's airspace is safe and the main Baghdad airport is functioning normally. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Chinese officials say an earthquake in a remote mountainous region of the country's southwest has killed at least 175 people and collapsed thousands of buildings. They say more than 1,400 people were injured in today's quake. Many are still missing. The quake's epicenter was in southwestern Yunnan province. Xinhua News Agency says the tremor destroyed 12,000 homes and damaged another 30,000. Fighting between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian separatists continued Sunday as investigators searched the site of a plane crash for the third day. Officials in Donetsk say six people were killed there in shelling and there were another three killed in Luhansk. Meanwhile, the remains of more victims from Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 arrived in Kharkiv today to be prepared for transport to the Netherlands. A medical group treating Ebola victims in West Africa says a growing number of areas are affected and limited resources are making it difficult to contain the epidemic, which has now killed more than 700 people. Doctors Without Borders says the situation in Liberia is dire because of a lack of trained personnel and resources. There are critical gaps in Sierra Leone and a resurgence of infections in Guinea. In another development this weekend, one of two Americans infected with the virus arrived back in the United States for treatment. They're being taken to Emory University in Atlanta, where Dr. Bruce Ribner works.
They have gone over on a humanitarian mission. They have become infected through medical care, and we feel that we have the environment and expertise to safely care for these patients and offer them the maximum opportunity for recovery from these infections.
The relief worker was evacuated on a special flight. And President Barack Obama will gather with nearly 50 heads of state from Africa in Washington this week for an unprecedented summit. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We're coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
For a long time, the African heads of state, as you know, go into some of these meetings with sort of shopping lists that are limited to their various national programs. But we've seen that it doesn't really take us far.
The U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit begins on Monday in the U.S. capital, Washington, D.C.
One was the misrule of law, or the rule of law, and ultimately what is the misrule of law. One was the issue of marginalization of minority or groups. And then the third one had to do with good governance and transparency issues.
Human rights activists make recommendations for the upcoming U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit.
Our issue has to do with the currency. We are so much concerned. If we are not careful, and now if the city continues to behave the way it is going, I'm afraid we don't have future. Employment, as we all appreciate, is dwindling.
And Ghana's labor force demonstrates in the capital, Accra. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The United States says all is set for the historical U.S.-Africa Summit, which begins in Washington, D.C. Monday, bringing about 50 African heads of state to the same table with President Barack Obama to discuss the future of the developing continent. VOA Zimbabwe Service's Sandra Nera has more on the first ever U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit.
Administration officials say the summit is an opportunity to discuss the future of an economically growing continent and how the U.S. can become a closer partner. The summit will focus on three sub-themes: investing in Africa's future, peace, and regional security, governing for the next generation. According to the Brookings Institute, the summit provides an opportunity for the Obama administration to open a new chapter in U.S.-Africa relations, moving from interaction on the bilateral level to a continent-wide engagement. The upcoming summit provides access to nearly all of the leaders of Africa, especially small and infrequently visited nations, and bilateral meetings help to instill confidence and credibility in United States, says the Institute, adding this is a diplomatic and symbolic opportunity that should not be missed. It will discuss a shared interest that will be needed if the populous continent of Africa is to meet the needs of its young people, healthcare, education, and opportunities in the workplace. Many say the first goal is to ensure peace and stability that is much needed for development. Speaking as she departed Addis Ababa today to join 50 African heads of state and government at the summit in Washington, D.C., African Union Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma said the meeting offers a great opportunity to Africans and their leaders to further refine their reflections on, quote, the Africa we want and how to make it happen with the support of partners such as the United States. Dlamini Zuma's spokesperson, Jacob Eno Iben, told VOA, although invited on individual basis, Africa is expected to speak at the summit from a common position on areas which are of critical importance to the continent's future.
For a long time, the African heads of state, as you know, go into some of these meetings with sort of shopping lists that are limited to their various national programs. But we've seen that it doesn't really take us far. How do we together as a continent reflect and pull our resources together and make sure that we chart the future that is to the benefit of the region, of the continent, to the extent that each individual country would have to benefit? I think this is the central focus of having a common position on various issues.
Iben adds that the summit offers a great opportunity in line with the AU's commitment and call for a skills revolution to develop the growing continent.
The basic thing is that the African Union delegation, as well as the member states, will be looking forward to making sure that the discussions will be contributing towards what the African continent has been discussing since they celebrated the 50th anniversary, which is how do we contribute to shaping the next 50 years for Africa. And then one of the things which the continent is having is just discussing on building up the capacity of the youth. You know, talk of a skills revolution, as the chairperson of the African Union Commission has been talking about, which basically coincides with what the U.S.-Africa Summit coins as investing in the future, Africa's new generation, or the next generation, investing in people, building skills, making sure that people go to school, making sure that they're healthy, and making sure that they contribute meaningfully to the development of the continent.
It is expected that the summit discussions and other side engagements with Corporate America will further strengthen cooperation between Africa and the U.S. at continental level, building upon the existing strong bilateral and regional cooperation. Not invited to the historic summit are presidents of four countries: Eritrea, Sudan, the Central African Republic, and Zimbabwe. ZANU-PF spokesman Rugare Gumbo dismisses the summit, saying Zimbabwe will not miss anything from Mr. Mugabe's absence at the meeting, quipping the invited African leaders are in Washington, D.C. to sip tea with Mr. Obama.
A non-event. It doesn't affect us at all. It might affect other African countries, but as far as we are concerned, our line is that we look east. So those who African leaders who are going there, they are going for dictation from Obama. Let them do it. We'll see how much Obama will give them. As far as we are concerned, our line is that we look east. The president will be going to China towards the end of this month. Chinamasa is in Asia. The Russian foreign minister will be coming to Zimbabwe. And as far as we are concerned, that is enough. We are an independent sovereign state. We don't have to be dictated to by anybody else.
Political analyst Charles Mangongera, though agreeing Zimbabwe may not miss much by not participating, differs with Gumbo's take on the summit.
Well, I don't think that in terms of its economy and trade balance, Zimbabwe tends to lose much. I think that this is almost like President Obama's signature program for Africa. As he finishes his second term, he would want to leave something in terms of his legacy, given that he is African, he's a man of African descent, and therefore he would want to do something for Africa. And this is his efforts to strengthen the relationship between the United States of America and Africa, but primarily in terms of global trade. This is something that benefits America, because America is looking for opportunities. It's looking for, Africa has been touted as a rising continent, as an emerging market.
Political analyst Rejoice Ngwenya differs. He says Zimbabwe will continue to lose out if President Robert Mugabe continues to be snubbed by countries like America that he says can help rebuild the country's economy. The summit will focus on three sub-themes: investing in Africa's future, peace, and regional security. Similar summits are held annually between Africa and Japan, China, Europe, and India. Meanwhile, the AU chairperson will on Sunday deliver an opening address at the Believe in Africa Day, an Africa diaspora-led initiative to showcase business opportunities in Africa. Reporting for the Voice of America in Washington, D.C., this is Sandra Nyaira.
In another engagement, the African Union mission to the United States opened its doors in a new facility called Africa House in an event in Washington, D.C. on the eve of the U.S.-Africa Summit on Monday. According to a press release, the African Union mission is aggressively trying to spearhead development, fight to eliminate poverty, and rapidly propel Africa into the global economy. And it will, no doubt, take a leading role in any outcomes from the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit and beyond. As the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit gears up to start on Monday, some non-governmental organizations are concerned that some other important issues may have been left out of the summit's agenda. Adam Shapiro is the head of campaigns for the human rights group Frontline Defenders. He said that in June, a large group of African NGOs came together in Washington to devise recommendations to give the U.S. government and to African heads of state. He talks about those recommendations with the VOA's William Eagle.
So the main, this fell into basically three broad areas of concern. One was the misrule of law, or the rule of law, and ultimately what is the misrule of law. One was the issue of marginalization of minority or groups. And then the third one had to do with good governance and transparency issues. So this group of African civil society representatives met in June and put together these recommendations, which are available at the website weareafrica.org. And on there, anyone can read the recommendations, and we have it available in a number of languages that are used on the continent, so it's widely accessible.
Wasn't one of these suggestions that U.S. government institutions like the Millennium Challenge Corporation accounts and AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, that they introduce certain eligibility requirements?
Yeah, there's a sense that these funds that are available, are being made available, are being done so in a way that doesn't take into account or provide enough monitoring for when there are abuses or when there is corruption involved, especially corruption is a big problem. And so what the recommendations are trying to get to is a point where, you know, there are conditions set from the outset and sort of benchmarks of I don't think that the recommendations really specified exactly what benchmarks should be there, but that's part of the process. These are sort of initial recommendations to begin a process with how to improve what currently exists in terms of investment or development aid for Africa. And then to take it to the next step would be to, you know, look at these recommendations, talk more with civil society, talk more with those institutions that are conducting this investment and development in Africa.
Do you see a recognition of the importance of human rights by the administration by not inviting to the summit three African leaders that have poor records? Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, and Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea.
Well, Eritrea and the United States don't have diplomatic relations, so that, from a technical standpoint, makes things quite difficult to invite that head of state. In terms of Omar al-Bashir from Sudan, he, of course, has been indicted by the International Criminal Court, so were he to come to the United States, he would be potentially under threat of arrest, and the United States would have an obligation to arrest him. Of course, Robert Mugabe faces sanctions initiated in part by the United States, so that also has legal implications. So I don't really see this as a recognition of human rights, because of course there are other heads of state who are coming. The leader of Guinea. My understanding is that the new president of Egypt will be attending as well, and others, you know, who have less than stellar human rights records, and about whom the United States government and State Department have certainly raised issues. I mean, the issue of human rights is not on the agenda at all in any formal way, and certainly not from what we're hearing, what the discussions will be about, that human rights isn't going to be explicitly brought up. So I don't think that this is really, you know, the kind of summit that at the moment is the kind of summit that those of us in the NGO, in the civil society sector in the U.S., and especially our colleagues from the civil society sector in Africa, would expect to see from the United States. And certainly, I think it's fair to say from those, our friends on the continent, that they had expected more from President Obama specifically. There have been previously, in the past year or so, other summits where African heads of state have been invited for the purposes of investment. China has held one. Japan has held one. India apparently has held one. Russia. In those summits, there was very low expectation from Africa that any kinds of issues around the governance or human rights or transparency or corruption would be brought up at those summits. But when it comes to the United States, there is an expectation that these kinds of issues would be on the table. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that, and that is a source of grave, I think, disappointment.
That was Adam Shapiro of the human rights group, the Frontline Defenders. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle here in Washington, D.C. The Ghanaian Labour Front has been boisterous of late. A series of industrial actions has been has seen thousands of workers marching to protest the poor economy and demand better living conditions. For VOA, Joanna Mante has more from the Ghanaian capital, Accra, on what sparked the demonstrations and what may end them.
Five separate demonstrations were organized against Ghana's government in the month of July alone. The largest was by the Trades Union Congress. It saw thousands of workers pouring onto the streets in all 10 regional capitals. More protests are planned for the coming months. A fall in the value of the local currency is considered a major catalyst for the labor unrest. Over the past year, the city has lost more than 20% of its value compared to the US dollar, sparking a significant rise in the cost of living for the ordinary Ghanaian. At one of the recent protests, this worker summed up their frustration.
Look, this country, we have a very weak productive base. And if you have a weak productive base and your CD, your currency depreciates that far, what it means is that it's just escalating prices of goods and services in the economy. So that's the whole point.
Ghana is reaping increased revenue from offshore oil fields that went into production in 2010. But about 50% of the country's budget is still provided by donor partners. Those partners have withheld money for 2 years because of government overspending. Therefore, the only source of revenue is from domestic sources, and this has to be supplemented by borrowing to make up the shortfall. To keep the national debt under control, the government recently had to freeze public sector wages and impose new taxes on items such as telephones. Richard Ampabing, the General Secretary of the Public Service Workers Union, summed up the worries felt by workers.
Our issue has to do with the currency. We are so much concerned. If we are not careful, and now if the city continues to behave the way it is going, I'm afraid we don't have future. Employment, as we all will appreciate, is dwindling. Salaries are also dwindling.
The economic downturn is affecting non-government workers as well. Some private steel producing companies operating in Tema, for example, have threatened to shut down over incremental hikes in utility prices, which have resulted in rising production costs. Pius Kwenu is General Secretary of the Construction Union of the Trades Union Congress.
Most of our workers are being made redundant because government is not paying for infrastructure development. Most factories are closing down. We want government to listen to workers. We want government to make a change.
The demonstrators are asking government to act to halt what they describe as a decline in the country's economy. Their demands include reversing the depreciation of the local currency, reducing the rising cost of living and petroleum products, and revamping of the railway sector. These have been presented in the form of petitions to government. Austin Gambe is a Ghanaian labor consultant. He says one way of ending the protest is for government to cut down on employment in the public service. It is estimated that government spends close to 70% of tax revenue on salaries alone.
We are in the age of rapidly changing technologies. Therefore, we may not need too many hands doing the same thing and therefore idle. The other thing is that our human resource management policies and procedures must be properly oiled to be in tandem with the labor law.
Meanwhile, Ghana's finance minister, Seth Tekpe, is rejecting the claims that the economy is in crisis. He says that challenges facing the country have been blown out of proportion. But Tekpe recently had to go to parliament to seek an additional $908 million to help manage the economy. Joanna Manti for VOA News, Accra.
The Global Leadership Adventures is a volunteer organization that affords teens the opportunity to share their experiences with other kids in developing countries. Shanice Ali from the United States is currently in the coastal town of Anloga in Ghana, participating in the Children of Africa program with the Global Leadership Adventures. I reached her in Anloga and asked about the program's mission.
We cater to high school students who are curious about the world, that are willing to go out of their comfort zone, travel to developing regions. We work in 10 regions. We have right now two programs running in Ghana. We have the Children of Africa program, and then we have the Building Healthy Villages. I'm involved with the Children of Africa program, which is more based on education. The Building Healthy Villages program is really focused on sanitation and building compost toilets, because that's, you know, sanitation is a big issue, especially in rural areas here in Ghana.
What has your experience been so far working in Ghana with the Children of Africa program?
My experience has been really remarkable. It really opened up my eyes. It opened the Pandora's box of questions of the world. And, you know, getting out of the bubble of, you know, Northern Virginia for me was a big deal. You know, like, we have a pretty privilege. And so when I first came to Ghana, I was 16, and it really opened my eyes. And I've traveled to the Middle East, and I've had other traveling experiences. But going to a place where, you know, they live very basically. It's a very survival mode, very day-to-day, hand-to-mouth living, and, you know, seeing how much they care about education and things that, you know, maybe we take for granted. And so having students come and sitting them down in a classroom that doesn't have electricity, doesn't have smart boards, we're still using chalk and chalkboard, and, you know, everything is in a student's eyes, and when I first came, very delayed, but they do everything in a very process linear way here. And trying to understand that it's not, you know, I tell my students that the grass isn't green on either side, it just is.
Why was it important for you to be a part of the Global Leadership Adventures team?
To be able to pay forward that message, to come back as staff and be able to really enlighten these students and share my experiences and help them along their journey. And I think, you know, students come expecting that they're going to be helping the children and they're going to be teaching, but ultimately it's these young students that are teaching them and that are giving them a more perspective and a different lens of the world.
Is this your first time in Africa?
No. I came to Ghana in 2010, so this is my second time here.
When you went there in 2010, what was your first impression?
A lot of culture shock, but, you know, the hospitality of the culture. You know, everybody shakes your hand, everybody greets you. It's not as, I think, individualistic as it is in the United States. You know, everybody just really caters to their own family and, you know, leaves it at that. Whereas here, it's more of a community, and it's something the students really take knowledge about. And what's unique to Global Leadership Adventures is that we work in a rural area, so we think that's the best way to assimilate into a culture. And so, you know, they interact with locals. We, on our staff, we have both local and international staff.
Tell me about the day-to-day operations of the program.
So we wake up in the morning, we do everything as a team. So right now I have a group of 33 students, and the groups are divided into three, and we work at three separate schools. So we wake up, eat breakfast, we go to our service site for 4 hours. I'm in the process of building a school, finishing up two extra classrooms, because we have such a mass enrollment at the school that there's no room. So GLA, we bought bags of cement and sand and working to mix those and make the blocks. And now we're building the foundation, and hopefully by the 12th of August, the two extra classrooms will be up.
Shenes Saleh is a volunteer with the Global Leadership Program. I spoke with her from Anloga, Ghana.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
VOA Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, music from our African collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, August 3rd. It's the final day of competition at the 20th edition of the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, Scotland. Some 71 nations and territories are featuring in the 22 events at the Games, which started on July 23rd. Going into the final day of competition today, Sunday, only 10 African nations have registered their presence on the medals table. Of the African countries, South Africa leads with 13 gold, 10 silver, and 16 bronze, for a total of 39 medals. The country is seventh overall. Nigeria is second in Africa and eighth overall, with 11 gold, 11 silver, and 14 bronze, for a total of 36 medals. And Kenya is third in Africa and ninth overall, with 10 gold, 10 silver, and 5 bronze, for a total of 25 medals. Other countries include Cameroon, 4th in Africa and 17 overall, with 1 gold, 3 silver, and 3 bronze, for a total of 7 medals. Uganda, 5th in Africa and 18th overall, with 1 gold and 4 silver, for a total of 5 medals. Botswana, 6th in Africa and 20th overall, with 1 gold. And Namibia, 7th in Africa and 26th overall, with 1 silver and 2 bronze, for a total of 3 medals. Others are Mozambique, 8th in Africa and 27th overall, with 1 silver and 1 bronze, for a total of 2 medals. Ghana, 9th in Africa and 33rd overall, with 2 bronze. And Zambia, 10th in Africa and also 33rd overall, with 2 bronze medals. England with 165 medals, Australia with 132, and Canada with 81, in that order, lead at the Games. Staying with the four-yearly Commonwealth Games, Nigeria is reeling from the withdrawal of the gold medal won by one of the country's representatives, teenage weightlifter Chika Amalaha, after she tested positive to banned performance-enhancing drugs at the ongoing edition of the Games in Glasgow, Scotland. Amalaha, who won the gold in the 53-kilogram category, has now been disqualified from her event at the Games. Dika Tua from Papua New Guinea has been awarded the gold medal. Amalaha was Nigeria's first gold medal winner in Glasgow. Nigeria's Sports Minister Tami Danagogo says heads will roll over the teenager's drug shame. "My heart bleeds for this 16-year-old girl. She looks too innocent to commit such an offense. She's naive. It is so unfortunate because it was this same girl that did so well in Gaborone, Botswana, and she was tested and was certified clean," the minister said. Away from the Commonwealth Games, four nations are through to the final qualifying stage of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations to be held in Morocco after the return leg matches of the third round were played this weekend. The countries are Botswana, Sierra Leone, Malawi, and Rwanda. Malawi and Rwanda won on penalties to seal their places in the final round of the qualifying series. The two sides overturned results from the first leg and then wrapped up victory from the spot. Rwanda played 2-0 against visiting Congo to level aggregate score at 2-2, necessitating a shootout to determine the winner. Rwanda prevailed 4-3. Rwanda now joins Nigeria, South Africa, and Sudan in Group A of the final qualifying. For its part, Malawi, playing at home, pipped Benin 1-0 to put aggregate score at 1-1. Malawi won the resulting penalties, 4-3. Malawi now joins Mali, Algeria and Ethiopia in Group B of the final stage of the qualifiers. And Botswana drew 1-1 in the second leg against visiting Guinea-Bissau to advance 3-1 on aggregate. Botswana heads to Group G of the qualifying with Tunisia, Egypt and Senegal. Sierra Leone reached the final qualifying stage after Seychelles pulled out of the qualifiers, scared stiff over the Ebola pandemic. Sierra Leone joins Ivory Coast, Cameroon and the Democratic Republic of Congo in Group D of the final qualifying stage. The remaining three teams to reach the last round of the qualifiers are due to emerge later today, Sunday. Now, the Ebola pandemic that has gripped the West African nation of Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone is beginning to take its toll on sports. As I reported earlier, Seychelles has pulled out of the ongoing qualifying series for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. The Seychelles Football Federation conveyed its withdrawal to African soccer's governing body, CAF, in a letter dated July 31st, 2014. Seychelles was scheduled to host Sierra Leone this weekend in the second leg third round of the qualifying series. Sierra Leone won the first leg 2-0 in Freetown 2 weeks ago. Apart from awarding the match to Sierra Leone, CAF said the Africa Cup of Nations Organizing Committee will examine the withdrawal, meaning there may be sanctions for Seychelles. Liberia, which is also affected by the Ebola pandemic, has suspended all football activities in an effort to control the spread of the Ebola virus. The country's football federation said there was a risk of infection because football is a contact sport. In related development, the Cape Verdean Basketball Federation, FCB, has cancelled the trip of the national basketball team to Guinea for the preliminary round of Zone 2 AfroBasket 2015 because of the Ebola pandemic in the West African nation. FCB Chairman Kitana Cabral said he's considering traveling to Ivory Coast to meet with the Continental Basketball Body over the decision. Finally, the friendly between two of the biggest clubs in the world, Manchester United and Real Madrid, has set an attendance record for soccer match in the United States. The match at Michigan Stadium drew a sellout crowd of 109,318, a new record for a soccer match in the United States. The previous record of 101,799 was set by the 1984 Olympic gold medal match between France and Brazil at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California. Fans paid ticket fees ranging from $45 to $189 to watch the likes of Wayne Rooney and Gareth Bale play. The previous record for a club match in the United States was set by a 2009 friendly between Barcelona and the LA Galaxy at the Rose Bowl, which drew 93,137 fans. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. We'll be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports here on Nightline Africa. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Mokako swato pesio, okende se liboso. Papa papa mama bilenge, ya solo toni miye. Dosengi senantambe, abakisela yo mikolo. Dosengi senantambe, abakisela yo mapamboli. Yo yo mona papa trise,
pepe ya masamba kinwani.
Yo yo mona papa trise,
chansi kinwani.
Yo yo mon papa Patrice. Ya nos mwa pa. Titi le Valois, Dengi Maya, ino ilama.
Titi ki mwani, milyona kongole.
Pierre Binda Alaf Molala
Oza Motina Miyazambe
Gaïta Mwana Kassala Ramazani Koïda
Didi Misolo Mwana Konga Kinshasa
Julien Poutou
Contoire Dikini Toujours na top
Machuda Mandangi
Espoir ya bana Africa, ezana maboko mayo, Didi Kinoani.
Pasquare Akawako, le parapluie de l'Afrique.
La main qui donne, c'est la main qui reçoit. Didi, ayana meda Kinoani, papa na ebiance.
Kinshasa, Amédéis.
La main qui donne, c'est la main qui reçoit Didier. Mais ça y est, qu'on soit un mingi qui noani, papa n'a dit
ça arrive à base.
Yabana Congo,
Edanzo
Lako, Konto Adikini Oye,
Yabana Mboka,
Yabana Congo,
Raouli Tumbo,
Konto Adikini Oye, 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 Tokumu, Yabana Congo, Yabana Congo, Oye, Yabana Congo, Oye.
Est-ce que Ozo Yoka vient là du novembre, papa n'a dit nana tonton. Il y a Didi qui nous a dit Yoka les sous qui t'arrouille. Mawa. Les vieux Bob et Mundabi, grand hôtel, le grand gestionnaire. Oyoki Bilan, on a l'ingaba. Et à Frisa, Seigneur l'œil, le monument vivant. Okulaka Emile, y'a Patimo Bali. Bienvenue Kamba Apocalypse 22. Jeff Makwiza, Claudine Mungwilu, Colonel Van. On n'a autant jamais respecté la nature de la musique. Maman Dela, PDG Selekine. Yavango, Molelisa Mate, Yaya, pardon.
Princesse Toutou, Bénédicte Dieudonné Pascal Ordi, le grand Kassai, Motima Yamoto, et Somba Makanambongo Teo Ben Amaluba. Et Tchè Tchè Tchernobyl, Motema Mwanga, Monsoui Nebokono, Malade Basouci, Oyo Esi Lakate. Comprimé Ninina, mais la poète Nazala consolé. Fabrice Coca, le grand pétrolier. Quel homme Paninda Baseka, Nende Moteme Kimanzoto, Sokimpeli Wananga Zambé. Nende Nangaya Kovivro Nali Kamwa Motote, Safuta Kananga Inyoso, Moniolo Loya Bozangi Tongi, Nakoya Makanisi, Nalusi Kuya Bandoto Nazala. Tona epoke na ye kasi ako sombaliwa soki beba sombaka tute vanite ya nini na milelaka Andrix Kabasele batika besa kati masimo motema ya moto esomba maka na maloba teni kambai boyango ezangitalo ya kopesa motuya. Bandeli ya mokili ezalaki ndeli loba kasi falanga te poyo mikokisa moninga kilolanga imoto na koteka te mpona bongo mbo bawela basanga basanga mpe basuwa simbungu laisse parler les gens na kati ya Bruxelles motema ya moto esomba maka na maloba ya kopesa motuya ebandeli ya mokili ezalaki ndeli loba legra kasai kasi falanga te poyo mikokisa moninga kilo na ngai moto na koteka te mpona mbongo bawela basanga basanga mpe basuwa simbumompaser timote tiang lisolo ya mboyo josian wate Apo Firenze Lincoln 3x5 José de London Makenga Lipata Bosana Kate Bole na ye Malili na mboka Kosunga Trupo ya Bameme na ye La via moto ezali Sela te po amona Mbasi Bomengo ekipaka Azete Yepona kanango Pelongite Yebaka kobatela Oyo ebe sameli Liyo Deni kambayi Chumbo Moshiro Chamala
Mama
Mase Mufunga Leo Mwanga London
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former United Nations Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Here's Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As African heads of state and government convene this week in the Africa-United States Summit in Washington, D.C., they and countless Africans must be wondering whether, at this point in time, the global order has collapsed. In the past few months and beyond, the international community has been witnessing major disruptions and turmoil in the international system. A number of acute crises in Africa, serious and dangerous maritime disputes in Asia and the Pacific involving China, the disaster in the Ukraine, the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Syria, Iraq, Libya, and currently the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. In all these conflicts and disasters, the U.S. President, Barack Obama, the host of the summit, is at center stage. Unfortunately, his capacity to act prudently is being circumscribed by the constant criticisms and accusation by his political opponents that he does not believe in American exceptionalism, whatever that may mean in today's complex international community. At best, the foreign policy establishment in the United States believes that his refusal to bomb Syria after a so-called red line has been crossed, his decision to lead from behind in Libya, his inclination to rule out boots on the ground in the Ukraine, in the controversy with Russia and President Putin, his cautious approach towards Iran, and his general approach to think first before acting on matters of war and peace have been judged as weak and making the U.S. opponents less frightened of the country. Given the nature and circumstances of his present difficulties, is President Obama in the position to tackle seriously the myriad problems of Africa? The sense among the African leaders is that the summit is vital for Africa. They do cherish good and cordial relations with America, even though from time to time some may be frustrated by certain policy position towards Africa. The confusion that many Africans may discern in current world developments may be linked to the enormous problems in knowing what actually is happening today. Are we witnessing the end of rapprochement between East and West and the reemergence of a new Cold War? It has increasingly become difficult to answer these questions because governments are presenting contradictory narratives of world crisis to bolster their foreign policy. Two factors come to mind. It is often asserted that truth is always the first casualty of war. And the great British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, once observed that in war, truth is so precious that it must be accompanied by a bodyguard of lies. In tackling regional and national problems, African leaders are at the mercy of the general unfairness of current international world order. President John F. Kennedy once famously lamented that life was unfair, fair enough, but an unjust world order breeds revolution and upheaval. When would Africa begin to benefit from its enormous wealth and mineral resources? For too long, the African people have been hoping to advance their economic development and prosperity. As the summit takes place, Africa is again confronting this unfortunate Ebola outbreak that is currently affecting three West African countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Their active involvement in meeting the challenge has compelled their presidents to cancel their presence at the summit, although they would be represented by other senior officials. At a recently held summit in Guinea, the three presidents are coordinating the efforts to contain the dreaded infection. With their meager resources, they are making their best efforts to bring succor to their people. Hopefully, the international community will come forward with assistance to strengthen their public health infrastructure. President Obama, who has roots in Africa because of his Kenyan father, will undoubtedly seek to reassure his guests about the United States' role in the maintenance of international peace and security. But African heads of state should not shy away from sharing their concerns with President Obama. African perspectives on disturbing factors in the continent, such as the problems in Libya, Egypt, and their current economic performance, should be discussed. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Odette Frazier. Hope you'll join us again on Saturday. Have a good evening.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
On the night of September 11th, 2012, members of the Ansar al-Sharia terrorist group attacked two U.S. government facilities in Benghazi, Libya. Using machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars, the militants targeted the U.S. Special Mission compound and a nearby annex in repeated assaults, killing four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador, wounding two more U.S. personnel, and three Libyan contract guards. Both facilities were destroyed. Rewards were offered, and an intensive search mounted for those responsible for the attack. On June 15th, U.S. military personnel arrested a key suspect in the operation, Ahmed Abu Katala, a senior leader of Ansar al-Sharia in Benghazi, has been charged with murder and other charges. Others involved in the attack remain at large, and the United States will do whatever it takes to see that justice is done. Created after the fall of Libya's longtime ruler, Muammar Gaddafi, Ansar al-Sharia has been involved in many attacks in the region, targeting civilians and assassinating or attempting to assassinate security officials and political actors in eastern Libya. Its members continue to pose a threat to U.S. interests in Libya and have been designated as international terrorist organizations. Toward this end, the Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of any individual responsible for the Benghazi attacks. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these individuals, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy or the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.